Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
We came to fight the GI, and our hearts were pure and strong. And death filled the air, we all offered the present, prepared for our martyrdom. But Allah has some other plan, some secret not revealed. Now they're dragging me back with my head in the sack to the land of the infidel. I shall do la ilaha illa Allah. I shall do.
Steve Earle wrote and recorded the song John Walker's Blues shortly after the September 11th terrorist attacks, profiling a disturbed young man who grew up in America, became radicalized, and joined the Taliban. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guest today will tell us that the danger of our citizens becoming radicalized by terrorists is even greater today, with the Islamic State, or ISIS, showing a sophisticated grasp of social media and the ability to reach and convert those who live on the fringes of our society. We welcome back to Route 51 Wausau's own Anne Speckhard, one of the world's top experts on the psychology of terrorism. She is an adjunct professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University in the School of Medicine and the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism. She's interviewed more than 400 terrorists, victims, friends, and family members in the course of her work. And her newest book, co-authored with Amit Yela, is titled ISIS Defectors: Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. She's using those stories now in an effort to fight the terrorists at their own game, using social media to keep ISIS from gaining new recruits. Anne Speckhard also has some strong opinions about the way President Trump is conducting the fight against terrorism, including his executive order temporarily banning travel from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. She joins us by phone this morning. And as always, we invite you to join us by phone as well. If you'd like to give us a call at 1-800-780-9742, that's 1-800-780-9742. Or if you'd like, you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it on the air. Anne Speckhard, thanks for being with us, and tell us about the new book.
Well, you're welcome, and hello to Wausau. The new book is based on 32 interviews with ISIS defectors or returnees. Not all of them were defectors. Most of them were Syrian. They were running away from ISIS and hiding in Turkey, and we managed to make contact with them through my colleague, a former police chief, Amit Yela. And some of them are in Europe, and we have now expanded the project. We have 43 ISIS defectors or returnees that we've spoken to.
And Amit, you mentioned his police background. He actually worked on counterterrorism with the Turkish National Police.
That's right. He lived in Urfa, Turkey, which is right on the border with Syria, and is a hot spot in Turkey. A lot of Syrians there, and many of them fleeing ISIS, some of them still part of ISIS.
How did you get in touch with these defectors? And when you did get in touch with them, how did you know that they were the real thing, that they were actual terrorists?
It's not easy getting in touch with a defector because a lot of them don't want to speak. They're worried about getting prosecuted, which they should worry about. And a lot of them aren't really interested to tell their stories. They're very traumatized. In Turkey, we got to them through Amit, and he started first with smugglers. He knew smugglers because he was former chief of police in Urfa. And then after we got going, we started working with one of the defectors who knew many more to bring them to us. And the way we judged whether they were for real or not was based on their stories, if they made sense, based on their trauma recall. People would freak out in the middle of the interview over really traumatic things, and I think that's a hard thing to fake. And you'd have to be a bit knowledgeable to fake that. Also by whoever referred them. In Europe, I talked to people, and in Central Asia and Balkans, that were in prison. So obviously they'd been convicted. And based on the court decision, I knew they'd been in ISIS. And some were referred by police, some were referred by other people. And again, the same criteria.
Wasn't this dangerous work, tracking these people down, finding them? Weren't you and Ahmed afraid that you might be captured or killed yourselves?
Yeah, I was afraid to go to Urfa. It ended up that this is the only time I've done interviews long distance. So Ahmed was in the room in Urfa, and I Skyped in. And I was really worried about how that would work because I've always relied on myself. I've interviewed about 500 terrorists at this point, Glenn. And I've always relied on myself as a psychologist and my people skills. And I didn't know how in the world that would work if Ahmet ran the interview, but Ahmet's really good with people as well. So he was good at it. And it turned out that when we did the Skype interviews, I could use chat, the chat feature on Skype, and I could say, Ahmet, I think this person is doing X, Y, or Z. So I could still be the psychologist, but I could inform him. And, you know, they didn't know what we were writing back and forth to each other on chat.
Essentially, but you were sending him text messages back and forth.
Yeah, yeah. The other ones I did in person. And, yeah, it's always dangerous because if the person hasn't defected, and especially knowing that I'm an American, they can come to the meeting wearing a suicide vest and blow us both up. Yeah, it's really dangerous work.
What did you learn from these defectors? What are the common themes to their experiences that informed you about some of the things that are going on right now with ISIS?
Well, in all my work interviewing terrorists, the whole point of it is to understand what is the pathway in. So how did they get on the terrorism trajectory? How far did they go on it? And if they backed up and gave up terrorism, why and how did that happen so that we could learn more about how to prevent terrorists and also how to rehabilitate and reintegrate them. In the case of the ISIS defectors, we found out how they got into the organization, how they were recruited, which was very different if they were Syrian, West European, or someone in Central Asia. So we found the different paths. We found the different motivations, the different vulnerabilities, whether they were recruited face-to-face or over the Internet or both, who paid for them to travel, how they traveled, how they arrived. Well, they all everyone we've interviewed has arrived through Turkey and was taken across the Syrian border, what happens when you enter ISIS, how you're trained, how long your training is, what you're taught, and what happens to you as you go along. And then since these were people that had walked away, what were the things that made them disgusted and disillusioned, and how did they get out? Because it's not an easy thing to get out.
You write that ISIS is being defeated on the Syrian and Iraqi battlefields, but not on the Internet, where they've been able to successfully recruit over 30,000 foreign fighters through the use of social media. Explain that to us.
Well, this is the first terrorist group that has been so prolific. And I don't think it's because ISIS is so good at it. I think it's because social media was so developed at the time that they came up. Because Al-Qaeda in Iraq managed to attract about 5,000 people. That jihad in Afghanistan against the Russians attracted, I think, about 3,000 people. So we've always seen foreign fighters, but we've never seen anything to this extent. And what's going on with ISIS is that nowadays you can make videos pretty easily. There's very good tools for making them. There's Adobe Premiere, which anybody can get a hold of. And they make technically good video. They put it out on the Internet. But what they're really good at is watching the social media response. So they send out maybe 20,000 different things, posters, videos, all kinds of recruitment materials and ideological statements. And if somebody retweets them, they know that. Just the same as if someone is Facebooking or retweeting about your show, you know who it is, and you can contact that person. So what ISIS does is they say, oh, you asked this question about us. Well, let me answer it. So there's a girl on the West Coast that tweeted, why would a terrorist group behead James Foley? That was the journalist that was beheaded. They answered her. They said, it's a revolution. You have to shed blood in the revolution. We're aiming toward this glorious caliphate. And sorry, we have to kill some people to get there. And they started a whole discussion with her and almost recruited her into ISIS.
You write, ISIS has a brand that sells its vision of a utopian Islamic caliphate and a path to justice to those who feel marginalized, discriminated against, fearful of their governments, or feel they're under attack by the West.
That's right. And we're seeing that especially in Europe, although we've seen it around the world. In Tunisia, we see young men that can't get married. So ISIS tells them, come to the caliphate, we'll get you a wife. So they're poor, things aren't working out for them. And they think, okay, I'll go fight with ISIS. I believe in this anyway. The idea of an Islamic caliphate is something in my mindset, in my idea of what Islam should eventually be, and I can get married. So ISIS has solved one of their problems. If you're in Western Europe and you're a Muslim minority, second generation, and you can't move ahead because there's a lot of discrimination that's stopping you, you're angry about it. Let's say you're in Molenbeek. There's 45% unemployment there for North Africans. ISIS comes to you and says, I have a job for you. It's a paid job. I have a wife for you. I have a sex slave for you. I have purpose. I have dignity. Do you want to live somewhere where being a Muslim is an advantage, or do you want to continue in your frustrated life here and constantly find that you're discriminated and marginalized because you're Muslim and immigrant descent?
So that's why they get into ISIS. Why did you find that they defect?
Because it's a brutal, horrible organization, and they're promised all kinds of things that don't come true. So I just was in Belgium and talked to a young woman who had gone through a rough relationship. She'd been married, and her man went and fooled around and left her. She was left with a child. She got on Facebook, created a new profile, called herself, I think it was Norma the Convert, and immediately had an ISIS recruiter telling her, I've got something much better for you. This non-believer that left you, why don't you live among believers? You can have a house. You can have a job. We'll train you with nurses training. We'll even give you diamonds. Somebody joked to me and said they should have told her she was joining Boko Haram because ISIS doesn't have diamonds. They have oil, where the Nigerians have diamonds.
Huh.
But she believed it, and now I've spoken to her since she came out, and she said none of these things came true. I was locked up in a house. I couldn't leave. When my child went out to play, I couldn't even be outside to watch him because I had to be accompanied by a male chaperone. So if my husband wasn't home, I had to open the door and let my kid go out and play by himself unaccompanied, and this is a little toddler. She said it was horrific. She tried to escape. One time she got caught. She went in a taxi cab with her son, and the taxi cab took her to the ISIS headquarters because they understood that she was trying to get out. And luckily, her husband saved her from instant death. If she'd been a man, she would have been beheaded immediately. And she did eventually get out.
But she said
it wasn't anything that was promised.
And some of the people that you've talked to experienced really brutal things. And not just to them, but they were forced to do brutal things, which eventually they said, I've had enough.
Well, we were told, we try not to ask people to incriminate themselves because in most cases we're videotaping them, and in all cases they're taking notes. So we don't really want to be the agent of them being prosecuted. But people have volunteered to us and told us that when you get into ISIS, they immediately send the men to Sharia training, which is to learn about their version of the Islamic caliphate and the laws of Islam as they define them, which are very strict and very brutal. And then they're also given weapons training. But at the end of their Sharia training, a prisoner is brought to them, and they are made to behead this prisoner. And ISIS films everything. So one guy told us when they brought me my prisoner, I had the knife up to his throat and I couldn't do it. And he said, I threw the knife and ran away, but I was arrested and put in ISIS prison. And he said eventually they let him out, but they put him through Sharia training again. And we didn't want to ask him because we didn't want to incriminate himself, but the assumption is that second time around he went with the program. But imagine, so right from your first steps, it's a lot like gangs when they make you do a crime so that you become one of them.
And you are trying to use these videotapes that you made, the experiences of those who defected, to dissuade others, perhaps impressionable, troubled young people in America, from joining ISIS.
That's right. Well, worldwide, actually. So let's say some of these interviews are 5 hours long, some of them are 2 hours long. But we go through, once we get a time transcript, we go through the videos and try to figure out what is the part here that could really be used to persuade other people not to join. So most of them, but not all, we've asked at the end also, pretend that you're speaking to a teenager, or pretend that I'm someone that wants to join ISIS, however we happen to do it. Would you give us advice? And most of these people just go off on a diatribe and say, ISIS is un-Islamic, the things I saw, what I had to go through to escape. I almost lost my life escaping. I saw other people losing their lives escaping. They're going to make you into a rapist and a murderer. Is that what you want? This isn't Islam. So we take those little nuggets, and then we video edit them into a very short clip and put it back on the internet. And you can see those videos. They're on our ICSVE YouTube channel, and you can link them to your show if you want to. And we've got 2 made so far, 2 in process, and we hope to make hundreds. We have enough material that we could make 200 video clips, and we use them for prevention. So going out to teach kids, this is what ISIS really is. Here's somebody from the inside that's telling you. We use them in interventions to get people riled up enough that they talk. These would be more radicalized people that are hard to reach. But if you show them something like this, they have a hard time staying silent. And we also fight with ISIS on the internet. We've been identifying radicalized individuals on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, and sending them the videos to see how they respond. Some of us tell us we're unbelievers and should go to hell, but at least we try.
If you just joined us, we're talking to Wausau's own Ann Speckard. She's one of the world's top experts on the psychology of terrorism. We're talking about her new book, which is titled ISIS Defectors, Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's 1-800-780-9742. And we're going to revisit the ISIS Defectors interview project again in a bit in the show. But I want to get into the new Trump administration and the steps they're taking in fighting international terrorism and some of the controversial things that they're doing. I think probably the best way to launch into that discussion is to listen to what President Trump had to say Tuesday night in his address to Congress.
According to data provided by the Department of Justice, the vast majority of individuals convicted of terrorism and terrorism-related offenses since 9/11 came here from outside of our country. We have seen the attacks at home, from Boston to San Bernardino to the Pentagon, and yes, even the World Trade Center. We have seen the attacks in France, in Belgium, in Germany, and all over the world. It is not compassionate, but reckless to allow uncontrolled entry from places where proper vetting cannot occur. Those given the high honor of admission to the United States should support this country and love its people and its values. We cannot allow a beachhead of terrorism to form inside America. We cannot allow our nation to become a sanctuary for extremists. That is why my administration has been working on improved vetting procedures, and we will shortly take new steps to keep our nation safe and to keep those out who will do us harm.
That's President Trump in his address to a joint session of Congress on Tuesday night. And Speckhard, what, if anything, is wrong with what President Trump just said?
Well, he's not wrong that Europe's got a problem and that Europe has seen some horrific attacks and that we certainly don't want that to happen in the U.S. But the Justice Department reports that I'm aware of highlight that the most terrorism has come from the far right and from white people living inside the United States, citizens. So neo-Nazi type attacks, things like that. So I don't know what he's referring to, and I think most experts aren't sure what he's referring to in that speech. But if we look at his visa waiver program, and we look at 9/11, most of the attackers were Saudis. Saudi's not on the list. The seven countries that he did list, we haven't had a problem inside the United States. And for the most part, we don't know of terrorists that have tried to attack that came for the purpose of attacking here from those countries. We do have one instance where two Iraqis came. They were caught immediately, and they were trying to launch an attack. But other than that, we don't have that kind of terrorism going on too much. I mean,
well, the world, you know,
he
mentioned the Pentagon and the World Trade Center attacks. More than 3,000 people lost their lives in those two attacks.
Right, but those were mostly Saudis.
Not from the seven countries that are listed on this travel ban. And do you think the president is minimizing the threat of white supremacists and neo-Nazis?
I don't know if he's minimizing, but he certainly wants to put an emphasis on what he calls radical Islamic terrorism. And there's no doubt that we should be worried about ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Whether we should label it Islamic terrorism, I wouldn't, because why do you want to mix up religion with pure and simple terrorism? And yes, certainly those groups try to use religion to support their ideology, but that's the same as saying the Ku Klux Klan is Christian.
He did start out his speech to Congress by condemning the recent desecration of Jewish cemeteries in America, the bomb threats to Jewish community centers, and the attacks on those two Indian nationals in Kansas. So, you know, let's give the president some credit for that.
Absolutely.
But you have a problem with him using the word radical Islamic terrorist. Why do you think that's a problem?
ISIS would like to create a divide in our societies, and that divide already exists in Europe, and it's one of the reasons that we're seeing so much terrorism in France and Belgium, for instance, because if Muslims feel that we are looking at them as terrorists and labeling them negatively, when most of them are just like us, they're, you know, they have a religion that, you know, is very similar to Christianity, very similar to Judaism. We all believe in the same God. They just have a different way of going about it, a different system. If they think that they're being labeled as terrorists, they can start to feel outside of society, and they may experience real discrimination and marginalization. And then, of course, there's going to be anger. And then, of course, groups like ISIS can come and say to them, well, that the West sees you as an enemy, so why don't you be with us?
We're talking to Wausau's own Anne Speckhard, the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, co-author of ISIS Defectors, Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. We're going to take a short break. Here's The Clash.
Hey, Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex brands. More information about Kimberly-Clark's 144-year history is available on the web at kimberly-clark.com. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
The moon is the same moon above you, aglow with its cool evening light, but shining at night into Niger, never does it shine so bright. The stars are aglow in the heavens, but only the wise understand that shining at night into Niger, they guide you through the desert sand.
Ella Fitzgerald singing about a night in Tunisia, taking us into our next segment of Route 51 with Ann Speckar, the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism and the co-author of ISIS Defectors, Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. You can find a link to that organization on our Facebook page. You can also put a comment on that Facebook page for Ann, or you can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. Ann Speckar, Tunisia is a beautiful, westernized, predominantly Muslim country on the north shore of Africa. It's a country which has had its share of problems with terrorism, including a beach attack which killed a number of British tourists, also the country of origin of the man who drove a truck into a crowd of Bastille Day revelers in Nice, France, killing almost 100 people. Yet it is not one of the countries on President Trump's travel ban list. Why is that?
I don't know how Trump came up with these countries. And if I was going to say where my worries are, I would be much more worried about the visa waivers we have from Europe. And I'm not saying that we should take those away. I'm just saying anybody in Europe that hates us and that is not known to his security services, who has a clean skin, can hop a plane, come over here, buy a gun, and mount an attack.
Last July, Foreign Policy magazine asked the question, why is liberal Tunisia, of all places, producing so many terrorists? Your translator, Mona, is Tunisian, correct?
She translated for us for two interviews, yes. Yeah, she was Tunisian, yes.
And Tunisia is often hailed as a success story of the Arab Spring because it's actually managed to stick with democracy since the downfall of its dictator in 2011. Why is a country like that, instead of a more fundamentalist country, producing, it seems, a disproportionate share of terrorists?
Well, I think it's producing a disproportionate share of foreign fighters who become terrorists. So let's start with where they started with, which is traveling, and why they traveled. And they traveled for wives. And they traveled for a dream of Islamic caliphate that will produce justice and prosperity for people. Of course, when they got there, they didn't get either one. And in many cases, they didn't even get a wife. So that's the answer. There's high unemployment, and there's a terrorist group that's promising things that don't exist to them.
Let's go to the telephone calls that we have online right now. We're going to talk first to Daryl in Corduroy. Daryl, you're on Route 51.
Good morning, and thanks for the program. My comment is, I don't condone these people, ISIS, but they must feel they have their reasons. Now, it's my understanding that maybe 100 people have died to terrorism since September 11, 2001, and it's been 16 years. The president, in his speech, stated that we have spent $5 trillion on terrorism since September 11th. I believe the American people are missing something very, very important.
All right, very good. And do you have a response to Daryl?
Well, Daryl's point's really well taken, and we need to be thinking about what we're spending our money on. Is it Tomahawk missiles, and are we ending up killing civilians and thereby making people want to join terrorist groups, or are we engaging in soft power that's useful? are we protecting civilians when they're trying to run away from ISIS? And, you know, if we're going to spend that kind of money, we better make sure we're spending it right.
Thank you, Daryl, for the phone call. Let's move now to Brad from Wausau. Brad, you're on Route 51.
Yeah, I heard you say that they should not call these people Islamic terrorists, and you compared them to the Ku Klux Klan, saying they shouldn't call them Islamic Christians. Well, if the Ku Klux Klan goes out, kills somebody, and says, in the name of Jesus Christ, you can compare them. When these people are going out and saying, in the name of Allah, cutting off people's heads, killing them, and using their God, screaming it, what else can you call them except for Islamic terrorists?
Ann Speckard?
You've got a point there. I still wouldn't call them Islamic terrorists because I wouldn't want to mix a religion that 99% of the world's population of Muslims are peaceful and don't support terrorism, with a small percentage that believe in the kind of things where they do scream Allah Akbar and that they're saying that they're killing in the name of their religion. Wouldn't want to mix those two things because otherwise we risk alienating the people we need as our partners.
Brad, thanks so much for the phone call. We really appreciate it. And I'm going to play one more audio clip from Donald Trump. This was on the campaign trail before he became president. We've played this before on Route 51, but it seems to be germane to the conversation we're having right now. We're going to play it now, and Ann will come back with your reaction to it.
And General Pershing was a rough guy, and he sits on his horse and he's very astute, like a ramrod, right? And the year was early 1900s. And this was a terrible problem. They were having terrorism problems just like we do. And he caught 50 terrorists who did tremendous damage and killed many people. And he took the 50 terrorists, and he took 50 men, and he dipped 50 bullets in pig's blood. You heard that, right? He took 50 bullets, and he dipped them in pig's blood. And he had his men load his rifles, and he lined up the 50 people, and they shot 49 of those people. And the 50th person, he said, you go back to your people and you tell them what happened. And for 25 years, there wasn't a problem. Okay? 25 years, there wasn't a problem. So we better start getting tough and we better start getting vigilant and we better start using our heads or we're not going to have a country, folks. We're not going to have a country.
That's Donald Trump at a campaign appearance before the election. Ann Speckard, you're one of the world's top experts on the psychology of terrorists. What's your reaction to those words from the man who is now our president? And what are the reactions that you would anticipate Muslims overseas would have to them?
Well, that's a horrible story. And I doubt it was as simple as he sent one guy back with this story and suddenly the problem was solved.
I would also mention that the story was not true. It has been vetted, and General Pershing didn't actually do that. So it was a made-up story.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because I wouldn't like to hear our U.S. military desecrating anyone. And the way he tells it, it doesn't sound like it was a court-martial or a execution that was justified. I mean, it may have been justified out of anger, but not justified, you know, going through normal military channels. So, but he also sounds like it's in the 1900s. I don't know. I never heard the story before. But do we want to desecrate our enemies? Absolutely not. Do we want to take Qurans and flush them down the toilet or do other things like that? No. And why don't we want to do that? Because we need to show respect for all religions and all peoples and people that we catch actually trying to carry out terrorism. We need to try them on their actions, not on their religion. And then we need to treat them in the way that we treat prisoners, which is not desecrating them in any way or disrespecting their religion in any way.
You've written that comments like that play right into the hands of ISIS.
Oh, they certainly do. I mean, what ISIS is trying to sell is an alternative world order. And thank God it's being discredited in Iraq and Syria right now. But people believe in it. They believe in this dream of the caliphate. And they dream of prosperity and justice for all people. And we have to face that a lot of Muslims are living under dictatorial regimes. They're angry. They get tortured if they protest against their regimes. And therefore, they look to groups like ISIS to free them. And they believe, I mean, the people that went to ISIS to fight Assad were fighting something that was horrible. Assad has done horrific crimes to his own people. And we have to understand that if we play into that and we further reinforce that the only thing you've got is ISIS to bring you justice, some people will believe it.
President Trump said in his first interview after being elected that torture works. Torture works. He has also said that we should have taken the oil from Iraq during the Iraq War. Again, do comments like that play into the hands of ISIS?
Absolutely. If you go through the Middle East, most people believe that the things that we do in the Middle East are solely for our own benefit. We didn't go into Iraq to relieve them of a dictator, which we did, but we came to take the oil. So when President Trump says something like that, he just reinforces their beliefs already, which is really unfortunate when you think of all the people that gave their lives to help the Iraqi people get free of a horrible dictator.
You've also expressed some concerns about some of the things that are happening during this temporary travel ban. I believe it was the day after it, we had a five-year-old boy who was handcuffed and detained for more than 4 hours at Dulles International Airport.
Yes, and, you know, if you believe handcuffing a child is ever a good thing, I mean, you know, if he was throwing a fit or doing something terrible, couldn't an adult calm him down somehow, distract him, give him some candy? But putting a child in handcuffs, isn't he going to remember that all his life? Isn't his family going to remember that, all his extended family, that because he was a Muslim and because he was of Iranian descent, as I understood it, he was an American citizen, but he was put in handcuffs? And I can even tell you all my counterterrorism expert colleagues from other countries that are Muslim now say they get really hassled at the airport coming into the States. Some have turned down invitations to come here to participate in events because they just don't even want to deal with us. And is that the way we want to be treating our partners? These are people that are fighting terrorism with us.
We had an incident over the weekend, I believe it was on Saturday, where Muhammad Ali Jr., who is a U.S. citizen, he was born in Philadelphia, he's got a passport. He returned from a conference that he was at in Jamaica, and he was detained by immigration officials and questioned for 2 hours about his religion, according to his lawyer. Now, this is the son of probably the most recognizable man on the planet.
We keep hearing stories like that, you know, that if you're a Muslim, you get hassled. And, you know, I think most Muslims are going to rise above it and say, okay, I guess our country's really afraid of Muslims right now. But there's going to be the few that are just going to get so angry that they're going to start to believe the other side. And the other side is telling them, your countries hate you, join us, build an alternative reality, build a new government. Destroy this one. And when Trump says we're not going to have a country anymore, that's completely ridiculous because our security services are so good, our FBI is so good. So people that start to believe those lies get caught, get put in prison, and their lives get ruined, which is really, really sad. And why would we want to drive anybody into the hands of ISIS if they would believe those lies?
We're talking to Wausau's own Anne Speckhardt. She's the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, the co-author of ISIS Defectors, Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. And we've got Bill in Wisconsin Rapids. Bill, hang on. We'll get to you right after this break. Here's Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Well, everywhere is war. War in the East. War.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Wisconsin Public Radio Association Endowment Fund, providing ongoing operating funds to help sustain the present and future operation of Wisconsin Public Radio. Support also comes from FarmShed of Stevens Point, offering a variety of educational programming and resources to expand the connection between the community, local food, and sustainable agriculture. More at farmshed.org.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger while traveling through this world of woe.
Emmylou Harris taking us into our next segment of Route 51 with Ann Speckar, the director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism and the co-author of ISIS Defectors, Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. Let's go back to the phones. We have Bill in Wisconsin Rapids. Bill, you're on Route 51 with Ann Speckar.
Hi. I just kind of had a question. Maybe you can have some commentary on this. I was thinking about how groups like ISIS or maybe groups like Richard Spencer's alt-right or any other extreme, localized or small marginalized cultural group might get more motivation to continually use or be involved in violent acts, and how that's the cyclical nature of violent acts from groups like ISIS or groups that we've seen since the election of Donald Trump perpetrating these kind of hateful words and acts, how they might be influenced by each other, how the marginalization of groups getting smaller and connecting with individuals, say in social media or in ways that they talk, how that and the violence are cyclical, and why they might be cyclical and why they might influence each other. And maybe you could shed a little more light on how that cycle works and how groups like ISIS recruit and how groups like the alt-right recruit in the same ways, and maybe you could shed light on why those two things cycle back and forth.
Bill, thanks so much for the question. Ann Speckar?
Sure. Thank you, Bill. I think the main point of the cyclical nature of growing off of each other is that each side promotes hate. And that's the thing that concerns me about the current administration's rhetoric, is that it also sounds hateful. And to hate terrorism is one thing. To hate an entire religion is another thing. And we've got to be really careful, especially with rhetoric coming out from high places, that we separate the two. And that's why I think Obama was very, very careful not to talk about Islam as a religion of hate or as a religion of terrorism, even though, as our earlier caller did point out, terrorists themselves claim that they're representing the entire religion. Go ahead.
Let's look at one of the chapters in your book, ISIS Defectors, called Cubs of the Caliphate. You interview Ibn Omar. He's a 15-year-old boy now who defected from the group. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Omar was, you can see his video actually on our website, the ICSCE website, and also on the YouTube channel. He's a little kid. He's 15 when we interview him, but he looks smaller and sounds smaller, and he starts to cry during the interview. And he tells us about how the ISIS guys came to his mosque, took over his mosque in Syria, and spun this picture of real beauty. And all the Syrians told us that the ISIS trainers were very well versed in Islam and spoke of a beautiful vision that they really got captivated by. Of course, when he ran away from his family and went to join the Cubs of the Caliphate in their training camp, he couldn't leave, So when he understood it wasn't what they said, he couldn't leave and go back to his family. And he watched as they tricked little kids into getting in cars, and these are bomb-laden vehicles, and ISIS has used thousands of these, which they run into enemy lines and explode at the last minute. So basically, when their second assault line comes, most of the people are dead because they've run all these vehicles, and they use little kids to drive them. And he was watching things like that they would offer them a tranquilizer before they went, that they would lie and say, you're going right to paradise, you won't feel anything, or not even tell them that they were going to die. And he knew that he was up next. He asked for leave of absence to go visit his family, and he was luckily granted it. He told his family what was going on and that he was going to be activated as a so-called martyr next. And his family insisted that he escape and go to Turkey. And he said that it took him an entire year in Turkey before he was able to leave the mindset that they had so brainwashed him with this vision that he, even though the things he had witnessed, the lies and the corruption and the horror, the horrible treatment of little kids, it took him a long time to come out of it.
Turkey has over 2 million refugees from Syria, I believe, according to what I've read. And we have very few. Are refugees from Syria, people like the 15-year-old boy who had to escape from ISIS, are they as dangerous as we've been told?
They're dangerous when they first come out of ISIS because they do get brainwashed and they need some time to, well, not everybody. Some of them are completely out of it when they escape and some of them never got totally ideologically convinced. But especially if they're children, they need treatment. And that's one thing that we really need to think about when we take refugees in is to look at their mental health needs. Because if they're coming from horrible conflict zones, they've got a lot of trauma, and trauma can be manipulated by terrorists. But does that mean we shouldn't help people that are fleeing from terrorists? I don't think so.
You write in a recent article, and I'm going to quote you here, Anne, terrorists can hijack the few verses in Christian or Islamic scriptures that they believe allow them to attack innocent civilians. It's not the scriptures that are the problem. It's the terrorists who hijack and twist and hate enough to convert religious beliefs into acts of violence. Those are who we need to oppose, not anyone's religion.
Yeah, I stand by those words, absolutely. It's horrible people that try to get other people to become monsters and to try to kill us. And what we need to do is rise above that, be better than that, and with open arms help the people that are running away from these groups. And yeah, it's possible that someone could embed themselves among the refugees, or it's possible that a refugee could get talked into being a terrorist, but so could a normal American citizen. I wrote a whole book about Shannon Connolly. She's Catholic. She lived in Colorado. She's white. She was talked into joining ISIS. So, you know, conceivably anybody can be talked into terrorism, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't help people that are fleeing horror.
And we are completely out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. And last thing, I just want to say, if anybody wants to support us, go to our website. We'd love supporters.
Give us your time. And we will make them strong. Bring us your far-run songs, and we will sing along. Leave us your broken dreams. We'll give them time to mend. There's still a lot of love living in the promised land. Living in the promised land.
We want to thank today's guest, Dr. Anne Speckard. Her latest book, she is a co-author of ISIS Defectors, Inside Stories of the Terrorist Caliphate. You can find out more about her work at annespeckard.com. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Woost El Balad, Steve Earle, The Clash, Ella Fitzgerald, Bob Marley and the Wailers, Emmylou Harris, and Willie Nelson. Thanks for riding along with us today. We've got a special live Blues in the School show next Thursday. You'll want to check that out. It's open to anyone, 10 a.m. next Thursday morning with the Becky Barksdale Band. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, until next week, we're heading out of town.